Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll have a spoiler-filled discussion about a movie we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on Ready Player One. Now, we're going to do this in two parts. The first part, we're actually going to talk about the book. We've both read the ebook version of that, although we have the physical book version as well. And then once we're done with that, we're going to pause for a bit, we're going to watch the movie, and then come back and talk about that. Now, this is a book that was written...
I believe 2011?
11 sounds about right. And... I heard a lot of good things about it. Obviously waited a little while to read it. We had some time, so we're doing that now. And I had kind of mixed feelings on it.
For me, there were portions that were a slow read because it got bogged down in details that I wasn't always concerned with. And there were other parts where I wanted them to spend more time.
Yeah, there were parts where it took a little too much for Wade to get through his day, and other parts where they just kind of skim over and wave the hands, and suddenly we're done with the hour-long Pac-Man game, or the Joust game, or, you know, whatever. Things that are more relevant to the plot.
Yeah, Gate 2 and Gate 3, for me, we just really quickly got through some of the activities in the gate, where I'm like, especially Gate 2, where I wanted more of the sensation of a video game being turned to live action.
Well, it's funny because I'm curious how this will translate to the big screen, because there are particular video games and TV shows and things like that they reference that I'm not sure they'd have the rights to for the movie.
Yes.
Or if they could necessarily pull off. And a lot of this claims to be steeped in 80s culture. Yet it's drawing from things from the 70s, stuff sometimes way later than even the 90s.
Yeah.
Into the aughts or whatever. And it's geek culture. Names are dropped, but in times with a little feeling of actual street cred to the geekness.
Well, Family Ties was mentioned, but not in a... I knew who my favorite sibling was, or I knew which one I wanted to be, or even really a description of the living room.
Well, because he was using the living room set.
Yes.
And, I mean, I remember watching Family Ties, but I can vaguely picture the living room, but not as well as I could others that I was watched more of, like either the Brady Bunch, or I Love Lucy, or the Dick Van Dyke Show, or... And it's funny, because I'm a kid of the 80s, pretty much. Or even the Cosby Show or something like that.
Or Different Strokes. And the reason I come back to Different Strokes is because the two characters that we're seeing this from, in terms of Halliday through his journals, etc., and then Wade, both have childhoods where they want to escape the real world. That's why they're going into all these pop culture references. That's why they're so involved in what they love. And Different Strokes was two kids who got adopted into a much better life.
It's interesting, though, because the story is about Wade, a high schooler who's going after the big contest prize, the Easter egg in The Oasis, the big virtual reality. To call it a game is to undersell it. It's yes. Now the internet, essentially.
Yeah.
But it's all based on the creator of the Oasis' childhood and stuff like that, and he's a kid of the 80s. So there are aspects of it where I would have expected it to have rung very true to the 80s from somebody who lived it, but is seen through a millennial who didn't and is trying to understand aspects of that.
A millennial or even a post-millennial.
An 18-year-old or whichever generation. And
I guess my point is I get driven crazy by some of the, like Minecraft, I guess, is the one we see at conventions where it's the highly pixelated, mm-hmm. It's supposed to be reminiscent of our childhood, And I'm so glad to have escaped that into the better graphics. And I think even now the millennials, they kind of think that's okay and enjoyable, but they appreciate the much better graphics they have.
There's a retro, not nostalgia aspect, but of the simpler time, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I felt they covered a little of that when they talked about Zork and the text-based games.
Yes.
But there wasn't a sense of, with Wade, when he would encounter side-scrollers or other classic video games, of it feeling antiquated, archaic, or quaint, or
yeah,
or something like that.
Well, and it's funny, because most of the time when we were in the text-based Zork, it had me trying to remember the text-based game that I had played so much. And I'm pretty sure it had Knight in the title, and it was one that was an evolution beyond just text-based, where you would do a bunch of text-based stuff.
But it would have easy, low-res graphics above it, yeah.
Low-res graphics above it, and then when you accomplish something, a little animation would happen.
Well, it's funny because you're just enough younger than I am that I think I fall more into the sweet spot of the 80s references and culture and stuff, having known of Zork, Adventure, and stuff like that. Not to say I played all of those. I was never a huge gamer. But to have the reference point a bit better.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm just a few years younger than the character. Halliday, I think you're just a few years older. So we kind of bracketed him. Mm-hmm. And some of the references, well, quite a few of them, like the TRS-80 color, kept making me think, well, we had a TRS-80, and I remember that computer vividly. It was the first one I used. But his computer sounded to be a model or two later than ours.
Absolutely. We had a Radio Shack Model 3 outfitted with a CPM card. CPM was an operating system that is very similar to but predates DOS, which is, of course, what Windows would later run on, etc., for younger listeners. And the color computer was a good couple of generations later in terms of just technology, because, well, it had color.
Yeah.
We had, at that point, character-based graphics and stuff like that. I mean, there were actual characters in the ASCII set that was a solid thing, or, you know, 2 pixels on top, 2 in the middle, 2 in the, you know, a 3x2 grid that you could draw stuff out with. And at one point, I actually did a periodic table kind of thing where you could step through and move the cursor around. So again, I fall into that sweet spot of understanding a lot of the tech references and stuff like that.
Well, and one of the computers they mentioned in Halliday's office toward the end was one we had. I guess it was the Columbia. Is that the one?
They mentioned a couple of things. I don't remember if they mentioned the Columbia there. They mentioned the TI-99-4, although I always put an A at the end of it because that's the model I'm familiar with. That was a Texas Instrument one that actually had some very early voice synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty cool.
When one of the things that they alluded to pretty early on but didn't really explain or talk about, and I think for millennials who haven't tried to play the old games that we grew up on, they should have explained. And I'm forgetting the right term for it now, but I dug out Ancient Arts of War,
mm-hmm.
one of the games we played in the 80s, and tried running it on one of our computers. And it was literally, you put in the disc, you start the game, and the processor is so fast that the game lost before you could do anything.
Yeah, there are some games that they didn't use the system clock. It's just, this is how fast computers work at this point. And it would go at that rhythm. But now imagine playing something at 10x speed or 100x speed.
Yeah.
I had a few other games. There was a Batman one where in the center of the bottom it had the health meter of Batman's mask, and it would just chip away at it until you see the skull. And I would play that on a faster machine years later, and it would just thump straight to the bottom.
Would somebody told me how to get, and I'm forgetting the right term for it, but you put this in first, and you told it, I want my processor to run at 10%.
You essentially do an emulation of a slower machine.
Yeah, and then I could actually play Ancient Arts of War. And what made that come to mind was when we got a brand new computer at one point in the 80s, we put side by side with the previous computer because they had told us the processor was so much faster. and we wanted a tangible way to know that. So you and I each played Ancient Arts of War side by side, and we did the same commands on the two computers. And I remember our mom making you take me to the grocery store to get something because she was cooking Thanksgiving meal or whatever. And when we came back, your computer was so far ahead of my computer because of the faster processing speed.
It's a time dilation at that point.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny because that sort of thing was never mentioned.
Yeah.
Ancient Arts of War, and I'm trying to think of some of the other iconic games of the time.
Oh, there was one that was a version of the Olympics.
Decathlon.
Yeah.
And also just how, at this point, people are living in the Oasis, which is a virtual reality thing. They've got suits that allow them to feel what the character feels, see what the character sees and stuff. But then to go back to a joystick and a fire button.
Yes.
You know, there's that aspect that wasn't really, I think, touched on too well. And it's funny, because they kept mentioning how Holiday was this huge comic fan, was into the geek culture and stuff like that. Yet we got a couple of movies he liked, a TV show or two he liked, a song he liked. Really, the comic aspect was negligible at best.
I wanted the book to have an appendix.
I think it would have benefited it to have had, essentially, the Anorak's Almanac or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Or excerpts from in the back. Where, you know, when they reference, like, Will Wheaton, you get the, oh, he's this, that, and the other.
Yes.
Now, most of us might know, but a lot of people might not.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of places where he would do a laundry list of favorite authors of the guy, start with full names, go to just last names, and then just kind of trail off as if we should know all of these.
Yes.
Or care.
Yeah.
And instead of making us more interested in this era of culture, it's like, well, okay, I recognize a couple of the names. I don't really care about the rest.
Yeah.
It wasn't an Easter egg that was, oh yeah, I really ought to rewatch this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
And it could have been. It annoyed me that some of the reference points were from the 70s.
Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, but we were told to expect the 80s.
Very much told, heavy-handed, this is the 80s period.
Yeah.
And then there were a few things that were just tossed in from later points. When Wade has a ship and it's a Firefly class ship, I mean, hey, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the Whedonverse, you know, sector of space or whatever.
Yeah.
But it feels out of touch and out of character for Wade to have done that.
Yes.
Versus, let's go pick, you know, why not have a Battlestar Galactica ship or some other lesser known 80s sci-fi show?
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think what would be a good case for that, but no mention of V. No mention of other big things of the time.
I actually think Galactica 1980.
Yeah. Even Galactica, it would have been just at the tail end of the 70s. I think that could have fallen in.
Yeah.
And I'll give him a year or so grace period. But
I just think the fact that it's called Galactica 1980.
Yeah. Well, and it would have had a good chance for a side riff if it wasn't as good as the original, but here they did this, you know, whatever.
Yeah. There was a lot of obscure Japanese stuff. Which surprised me.
Yeah. I felt it was a little less obscure maybe than you did.
Yes.
I was familiar with Ultraman. I was obviously familiar with the Spider-Man, which was a 77, 78 show, not 80s. There was a tangential reference to the Voltron Lions. It was cool, but it was not as geek authentic, I guess would be the way to put it, as I felt it could have been.
Yeah.
It felt like this was somebody who was catering to that audience, not somebody who was that audience.
Yes.
And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the author is very much of that ilk.
Well, I felt like he was trying to hit the broadside of a barn in terms of he was trying to hit everything he could think of from the 80s.
And that's a good way to put it. It was very much a, this is what I remember of the 80s, let's toss that in. Because, I mean, the Rubik's Cube, that could have easily been a lock, sort of a puzzle for something.
Yeah.
When Wade had his own video channel, he was not doing Saturday morning cartoons?
Yes, yes.
You know, things of that ilk. There were missed opportunities. I enjoyed the book. I thought it was good. But I also thought it was a mishmash of Harry Potter, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and 80s culture thrown in.
Well, in terms of wittiness, cleverness, writing style, whatever you want to put under that broad category, when we went through the Time Wars books, I mean, I was highlighting quotes left, right, and center. I was just loving the turns of phrases.
Yeah.
And there were so many things. It was, oh, wow, I got to point this one out to John and see if he caught it. Or, oh.
Good back and forth between the characters or something. Yeah.
This amazing detail, that kind of thing. There were only three things that I highlighted in this whole book. And one of them I highlighted because it made me wonder when the book was written. One was up in chapter one. And I thought he kind of encapsulated the character's motivation, I guess. Because he said it was a dream worth chasing. And I did like that turn of phrase. And I thought, okay, for Wade, his life has been kind of aimless, goalless, purposeless. And now, this Easter egg in the game, he finally has a dream. It may not be attainable, but it's worth chasing.
Well, and that was the beginning part, not that line specifically, but around that point, was what gave me the Harry Potter kind of a reference.
Okay.
The Oasis is the magical world of Hogwarts, if you will, where all things are possible.
Yeah.
He's got a less than stellar life out there, much like Harry had.
He might as well be living in the closet under the stairs.
The cupboard, but yeah.
Yeah.
And the Gunter's terminology, like the Muggles, you've got a little bit of the verbiage kind of a thing going on.
I thought they did a very poor job for me of establishing how he truly felt about the aunt, the home life, and I felt Mrs. Gilmore deserved more time up front.
Yeah, she was literally an extra in the story. One scene and ramifications after it, but never really seen again. She wasn't built up to have...
Yeah. Given the emotional resonance she's supposed to have later, she should have had more up front.
Yeah.
Even if what that more up front was her checking in with him daily.
Well, it's funny because in Harry Potter, I always felt the first book was very much the merits, the demerits, the artificial point system. Here, it was the keys, the gates, and very much marking kind of plot point one, two, and three, or act one, two, and three, sort of boundaries, almost. And again, the leaderboard having the ranking and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
To give that artificial sense of plot progression.
Yeah.
And there were times, like, between the keys where it's like he's spinning his wheels.
Yes.
So it was the author's first book.
Yeah.
Much like Harry Potter was an author's first book, J.K. Rowling's. And I think there's a little bit of first book syndrome kind of thing going on.
There was at least once where I thought, you know, if I was him, I would have checked the scoreboard at this point. And I was a little frustrated he didn't. I thought they did a good job with the H character.
I thought so, too.
I was disappointed throughout with Artemis, that arc. I'd been led to believe Artemis had a bigger role.
I thought she had a fairly significant...
More screen time equivalent.
Fair enough. Wade was clearly the lead character.
Yes.
I would toss up between Artemis and H as to who the secondary was. And I would say they kind of tie for the Ron and Hermione roles, if you will. And then you've got, Sato and,
Daito?
Daito and the two brothers.
Yeah.
That are the equivalent of the Weasleys.
Yes.
You know,
You've got Og.
Got Og, who's the equivalent of,
Probably one of the professors.
Yeah, I was gonna go with the headmaster.
Ah, yes.
Who I'm blanking on. Been a while since I've either read or watched Harry Potter.
Yeah.
So, to me, there's some parallels to be had there.
Well, I mean, I only heard from one or two people when they saw Ready Player One, and I asked them, you know, no spoilers, I want to see it myself. But given they came out talking about Artemis, and what a great character she was. So, to me, that equated to the equivalent of more screen time, versus there was chapter after chapter after chapter without Artemis.
I guess for me, a great character doesn't need to have a lot of screen time. It's how they use it.
I was disappointed at the end.
The end seemed to be a little abrupt overall.
There was part that, but there was also... She had stated, implied, you'll be disappointed when you meet me. I'm not what you expect. I was expecting, in real life, she's blind. She's deaf. She's in a wheelchair. She's something. She's concealing something other than a birthmark.
Blind and deaf would have been hard to do.
I agree.
In a wheelchair would have been interesting.
I mean, I wanted there to be something that the Oasis freed her from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. why was she spending as much time in there as he was?
Yeah.
I'm curious how that part, and age for that matter, translate into the movie.
Yeah. I mean, for H in the Oasis, H is on par and equal, and there is no prejudice compared to others.
Yeah.
And I wanted something similar for Artemis.
There needed to be a bit of a reveal there or something. Yeah. And there kind of wasn't.
Yeah. I was like, so she's exactly what we were expecting and she thought we'd be disappointed that, I mean, yes, teenage insecurities, I get it. But it's a letdown compared to what I hoped for.
I chalk that up to, again, first book syndrome or whatever. Because there were a number of places where the authors... Oh, yeah, and Wade had done this previously, I just didn't tell you.
Yes.
That got a little annoying.
Yeah.
It's like, you're writing the whole book before you release it.
Yeah.
Squirrel that away earlier.
Yeah.
You know, put that earlier in the book to where it's...
the foreshadowing.
Seeds have been laid.
Well, I mean, we spent time with H in the basement. So we could have had the joust machine in the corner.
Yeah.
And a few things like that. And some of that is we've been to panels at Comic-Con where people have talked about when you're writing, visualize the entire room. You may not have to describe the entire room, but know every item in the room. And then as you're writing, if you realize later, oh, it's relevant, go back and mention as I turned past the joust machine to look at.
Or if even you said, hey, we could play joust. No, I'm never playing you that again. Except yeah. Have a line of dialogue that pays off later.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, when it becomes convenient, then mention, oh yes, he's got this long history with the game.
Yeah. Well, IROC disappeared.
Yes. That disappointed me. There needed to be a coming to terms there.
Yeah.
Did he feel bad about it? What happened? You know. So there were opportunities. It was a good book. It was a fun book.
Mm-hmm.
But there was opportunities for it to have been a much richer book.
Yeah.
Than I felt it was.
Well, and that goes back to the pacing.
Both the pacing, but also this is a book about an Easter egg in a game. There should have been Easter eggs throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
That if you catch the reference, you catch the reference. If you don't, you just keep moving without missing anything.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it was Pac-Man that was probably the best game about it when we were kids, but it would pop up Ready Player One and then Ready Player Two when it was your turn.
And there were a couple of times that phrase, I think, was applied to the book late in the game, because there should have been, like, when the joust game was starting, like, Ready Player One.
Yeah.
You know, and have that as a recurring mantra, if you will.
Yeah.
So there were opportunities that were missed. But not to the point where it's like, geez, the book sucks. No, it was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But it didn't make me feel like I was reliving my childhood either.
No.
Or a future kid reliving that era.
Yeah.
You know, I felt there should have been things that felt a bit anachronistic to Wade that weren't there. And it just...
I felt there were some decent life lessons in there. In terms of, yes, it's a competition, but it's a game. And you come out of this a better person than you may have entered, in terms of realizing you can't do it alone, much like life.
Well, and it's funny, because in that respect, I'm curious who they've cast as Og and Holiday in the movie.
Good point.
Because those are kind of the wise men.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who I would cast for them.
Now, one of the things I would be tempted to do in the movie, if I were the one making it, I would have something about Kira. Something about Og and something about Holiday resemble or strike a chord with the audience for each of the keys.
Yeah, yeah. They were the three key members or whatever that led to the Oasis, and here's the symbolism for that. That would have been interesting.
I would also have something at the Crystal Gate that made you realize that to Holiday, it takes three, because to him it took the three of them.
Well, that goes back to a key aspect of that third gate was Schoolhouse Rock. And I'm not going to claim to be a Schoolhouse Rock expert, but I did not remember that one at all. Now, if you done Conjunction Junction,
yes,
or How to Be a Bill, or you know, a few of the more iconic ones. Now, I get, hey, go for the obscure.
Yeah. Well, there was no Sesame Street. There was no PBS
There was
PBS
a reference
shows.
To it.
Yes, there was a reference to it.
So, and that's, again, there's everybody had different touchstones in the 80s, but I think there were some that were much bigger than the others.
Yeah.
And they were just given a line or two here and there, and that's it.
Yeah.
Whereas others we reveled in so much. You know, the Blade Runner scene, the War Games scene, and a few things like that.
Yeah.
And it comes down to maybe they made a bigger impact on either the author or somebody else than they did for us.
Yeah.
Well,
the only other quote that really caught my eye in terms of bordering on laugh out loud, because I thought it kind of captured the sense of humor of Wade, was when the clans began to bombard the outer force field with rockets, missiles, nukes, and harsh language.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting because when they set up IOI, which is the internet service provider that's out to take over the Oasis if they can win the game and do whatever it takes, and how when the first gate was found by them, they put two force fields around it to use like an airlock.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, that's clever.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing that on the screen. But it also was just the corporatization of a game, if you will.
Yes.
Of how we can, oh, we'll have somebody else trade off because he's better at Joust, this person's better at that, or whatever.
Yeah.
And particularly the scene where Wade is talking with the guy as they're recruiting. It was, I think we could have and should have gotten a better sense of the Gunter, the egg hunter Gunter culture, yeah, than just they've got message boards.
Yes.
You know?
Well, and message boards seemed very outdated for the concept of the Oasis.
Yeah. I could see wanting to have something text-based where you don't have to physically go there or something. But it also seems like if you've got half the planet searching for this thing, listening to what they have to say, does that really help you?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, there should have been a massive library he was going to or something.
Yes.
I guess I would have taken the challenge a different way than Wade did. So you said you had three...
The third quote that caught my eye was the one that made me wonder when it was written. Because it said the only people who could get elected were movie stars, reality TV personalities, or radical televangelists.
To me, I took that as a sign of cult of personality had taken over.
Yeah.
Celebrity had risen to a new level.
Yeah. It made me wonder when, compared to American political situations, it was written.
Yeah. Well, and I thought the name dropping of Will Wheaton and Cory Doctorow or whatever was interesting.
Well, but there again, Will Wheaton, I mean, Stand By Me, but he's really more of a 90s name.
Next Gen started in 87, so you've got that.
87 or 89? 87. 87. Interesting.
So, the fact that, okay, it was never referenced as he played this and,
yeah,
what he did after, you know, Star Trek, or, you know, not even mentioning Star Trek as a connection to him.
Yeah.
It's either you recognize the two names or you don't.
Yes.
So there's not an inclusiveness or an education of exploring, which is counter to the Wade character, who, when he hears a song, instinctively is rattling off the album and the year and the band.
Yeah. Well, and there was a mention of Doctor Who's TARDIS,
mm-hmm,
which I don't think of as from the 80s.
No, because there was the 1996 TV movie. I think the original run lasted into the 80s.
Okay.
But, again, it would have been on PBS reruns regardless.
Okay.
But that's another one where, given Wade is such a habitual, let me explain this to you, or, you know,
yeah,
sort of a thing, and he's telling us his story, to not have it as accessible as it could have been. And again, an appendix kind of a thing,
mm-hmm,
where he has the sides or something like that. This should have been his almanac.
Yes.
That we were getting.
Well, and I think that's actually the best idea for an appendix, is Wade's almanac for the appendix. And it's, you know, at this point...
Well, Percival's perspective.
Yes. You know, the egg has been claimed, but if you want to watch all the things that help you get the keys and feel the experience, watch these things.
Yeah. What I would be tempted to do, I don't know if I would do it for a sequel, is I would have the survivors kind of there at the end, setting up their next quest for when they retire.
Yes.
I.e. maybe it's a generation later.
Yeah. Or helping Og set something up.
I think Og would help them set up the next.
Og has no children.
Well, no, but I know. But what he would do is he would say, okay, Percival, this is what Holiday's thing was at the end. You've got time.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner or later, you're going to have to hand the reins over. How do you want to pick your successor?
I'm just thinking Og needs a successor also.
I took it as he was retired, so he didn't need one. But
I'm just thinking he's the all-powerful Og. His robes go to someone.
I suspect they go to Artemis, but that's just me.
Interesting.
He was a fun character. I hope they cast well for that.
Yeah.
And I hope the visuals are good, but I hope the story in the movie is good, because there are certain parts of this I think you could trim down and cut. Other parts, I don't think so.
I hope they cast Sorrento well.
Yeah. Yeah. Because as the face of IOI, you need to have somebody that is at first, I don't want to say kind of charming or whatever, but somebody who then you get the teeth.
Just charismatic enough. But I think the most important scene for Sorrento is the chat link scene.
Yes.
Where he goes from calling him Parzival to calling him Wade and threatening the trailer park.
The actor I would be tempted to go for that is the one from of Mentalist.
Simon Baker.
No, not the one who played the Mentalist. The one who played the Kang.
Yes. Yeah. Tim Kang?
Tim Kang was the actor. He was also in first season of Cloak and Dagger. Because I think he could do the, you should come work for us.
Yeah.
Oh, you want me fired? Well, we're going to have you killed.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he was good in Cloak and Dagger with that kind of, yeah.
I think he could play the would-be game, or is game designer, but can't get this game and get, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm curious who they kind of cast there.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different ways you could go.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good. It read a little slow in places, a little fast in other places. I think the author shows a lot of promise, did a good job on this.
Yeah, Ernest Klein.
Ernest Klein. But there were a few places where I think it could have and should have been a little better. Instead of a laundry list of names or just toss out references, make me feel that I'm part of the time.
Yeah.
And that's as much up on editing as anything else.
Yeah.
I hear there's a sequel in the works. Don't know if I'd go for that. I mean, in terms of would I do a sequel to this?
Yeah.
It's got a reputation now that it's a big boots to fill.
Yeah. You know, up until pretty late, at least halfway in the book, a 7-year-old wants to borrow the book from me. And up until then, I was like, yeah, this is no problem for young readers. And then there was a passage.
There was one section that I don't think was all ages.
Yeah. And that disappointed me.
Yes.
I'll have to talk to the 7-year-old's parents before offering the book.
Absolutely.
And that disappointed me.
I expect that would get cut from the film.
Yeah.
And there were a few places where there was some profanity that I didn't think needed to be there.
Yeah.
And I think it could have been a much more all-ages appropriate sort of a thing than it was.
Yeah.
But I think to make it all ages appropriate, I think you also need to make it a little more accessible than just the laundry list of names or things like that. You're trying to get a number of different age groups into a particular period of time.
Well, the prologue was full of footnotes. And I think that's why not having favorite books by those authors, etc., as even footnotes kind
of bothered me. I was almost expecting footnotes later, and then it just stopped at that point. I was surprised.
Yeah.
And disappointed.
Yeah. You know, this is the kind of book I want to come out of with a, wow, that was so interesting. Now I want to go read these other things he talked about so much. I want to go watch War Games.
I wanted that, but I also wanted to come out of it with, you know, I don't want to go up against this guy in an 80s trivia contest.
Yes.
And honestly, I didn't feel that way.
Yeah, I can see
that. I think I could do okay. Certainly in my areas of expertise, I could do great.
Yeah.
Others, not so much in the music or whatever, but still.
Yeah.
He felt like he was a tourist in this area, not a native.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to my broadside of a barn approach theory. Of he didn't zero in just on what he excels at. He tried to capture everything. And as a result, he just hit the surface of so many things.
And it may be that it was just too scattershot, not focused enough. And again, trying to go for what he thought the audience wanted versus...
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's hard to tell what the deal was there.
And it'll be interesting to see if the movie, because it is presumably shorter, is more focused in that sense.
My understanding, it's about a 2.5 hour plus film, so they've got some space. But I expect a number of things to get changed or cut due to licensing or things of that sort.
Yeah.
Like if we get the Lepardon Marveler robot at the end, I'd be shocked.
Interesting, yeah.
Just again, rights.
Yeah, exactly.
And I hope they can really sell the concept and there are aspects where the movie has an advantage because I think you can make it feel more 80s in less screen time than it takes to explain what the basement looks like, what the Family Ties set would look like, stuff like that.
Yes.
People may not get it, but if you do, you do.
Well, even just the graphics, the dot matrix printer, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's easier to show.
There are a lot of things you could do fairly efficiently there. And I'm wondering if that gives us more the 80s vibe than the book did.
Yeah.
So I'm curious.
Yeah, me too.
So, shall we watch the movie?
Yes, please.
Cool. So we've just finished watching Ready Player One, and most of the cast was unknown to me. Simon Pegg, obviously, from Star Trek, from Doctor Who, from all Mission Impossible, all the stuff he's done as Og. Everybody else new to me not for the most part, but entirely. I found it interesting how they stuck to the spirit of the novel, had a lot of the same sorts of scenes, but they played out fairly differently.
Well, it intrigued me because it felt vastly different, and yet they had direct quotes from the book.
What quotes in particular stood out?
You know, it's sad. We just watched it, and yet there were a few places where I'm sitting there going, that's a direct. You could be a 300 guy.
Oh, yeah, the bit with Chuck.
Yeah. That conversation was with a different person, I think. He had directly with Artemis, and I don't recall if he had it with H also or not.
It was an inner monologue in the book about Artemis, but he and H had it back and forth here.
And he did have it with Artemis.
Yeah.
Because it was a little bit of a running gag with them at one point.
And she was the one who went through essentially the internment camp or whatever they called it.
Indentured.
Servitude thing. Here it was a loyalty center.
Yeah, which I thought indentured made more sense than loyalty center.
Loyalty center seemed like how they would have marketed the program.
I guess for me, indentured work because it was a historical callback to how people first came to America.
It's way more accurate, but that's why I don't think they would have used the term.
Ah, okay.
But the race at the beginning versus the D&D module.
Yes.
They did things that were more video gamey.
How you got the keys played out very differently. What happened once you had the keys played out very differently.
The concepts of the gates weren't even there.
Yeah. Except possibly the last gate. Possibly.
Yeah, kind of. The get the egg sort of thing. And even that was a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't have to play... Because that's where he played the adventure game, I think.
Yeah.
So they kept the basic trajectory of it. But it's like almost every scene was retooled. How the high five met.
Yes.
Was radically different.
How people traveled felt different in terms of Wade was concerned about money for fuel, but he had the car. He wasn't bound to one, quote, planet within the Oasis.
He was not bound. He wasn't a student, as far as we could tell.
Yeah, he didn't need the endorsements for money.
Didn't have the endorsements, absolutely. The whole poor, rich aspect wasn't there. He was a celebrity, but not as much of a celebrity as it felt like in the book.
Yeah. It felt like we witnessed less of the rise from impoverished to, okay, now I can't afford to do things. Whereas at first in the book, the only way he could figure out how to travel, even on the planet he was bound to, was to get the free voucher from school to go to an away game, which I thought was incredibly clever.
Well, it was clever, and it also showed how the game was accessible to everybody.
Yes.
And here, when he was first searching for H and found the planet, the place, etc., that completely undercut one of the points of the book.
Yes.
Where there was a high-level artifact that you could use to find out what sector, what planet, and it took multiple attempts to go do that.
Yeah.
So the ticking clock aspect was very different.
Mm-hmm.
The introduction of the brothers was very different.
Yes.
The younger one, as an 11-year-old, worked really well in the movie.
It did, yeah.
I thought that actor did a great job with the role.
Yeah, I love the ninjas don't hug.
Yeah. What should I do? Wear a sign, I'm 11, hit me, you know, kill me now kind of thing or whatever.
Yeah.
I liked how the entire high five survived.
Yes.
But it also undercut an aspect of the book, which really showed what a bad guy Sorrento was. because Sorrento had him killed and stuff like that.
Yeah, Sorrento, we kind of saw his bad side, but it wasn't as clearly laid out for us. In terms of, we saw the trailer park get bombed, but it was less premeditated. In terms of, in the book, the bombs were laid before the chat link conversation started.
Yeah.
So that was kind of it felt like it was more spontaneous.
Here they send a message, he answers the message. In the book, it was like literally they sent one a minute for days.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and in the book, they had made sure that within the rubble, the gear for a meth lab would be found.
Mm-hmm.
So Sorrento didn't look as bad here because it was less clear cut.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you get in a book that you have to show but you can't tell here, and they did show but you had to be watching for it, was when he was Mega Godzilla. He was willing to step on his own people. He didn't care who he killed to get to his goal.
Well, and that was something else that was a little different. Here in the loyalty center, they had like phone booth type things they were in.
Yeah.
Versus the sleep pods and the cubes.
Yeah.
So that was a little different. But also, when in the war room they respawned, they had to get out of one rig and into another. That whole thing seemed a little ridiculous. If they had said, okay, you're out for 60 seconds, so you're out, next person's in, and you get back into a line and then...
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. Have twice the number of people you need.
Yeah. And give people, a 60-second break between lives. Because they were physically having to run when their avatars ran.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and in the book, not that we saw the prep for it, but Wade's decision to go into the indentured program was more premeditated than Artemis taking advantage of the fact that Sorrento's underling came and arrested her.
Yeah, that was an opportunity versus a plan.
Yeah.
They seem to be a little bit more reactive here.
Yeah.
Than in the book.
The book felt more strategic.
Yeah. More of a gamer mindset. I'm going to do this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Whereas in this was video gamey, not strategy game.
Yes.
Here, again, the race at the beginning. And it's much more cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I knew there were going to be changes for the movie to make it a little bit more visual. I liked how at the end when we got his room growing up for Holiday, that we saw the Rush 2112 poster, the Joust game, and mm-hmm. things from the book.
Yeah.
But all of those things were gone from the movie.
Yeah.
And what they replaced them with didn't feel as iconic 80s. And it's funny because we had talked about how there should have been like a library and stuff about the guy, and boom, first thing we get in the movie is that.
Yeah.
So I think some of it was I don't want to say fixing flaws of the book, but shoring up some weak points.
Well, the author contributed to the screenplay, which means there was that chance for second thoughts, or he'd had time to say, you know, I could have done this.
Yeah, and on the one hand, I appreciate that. On the other hand, I think it'd be interesting if the Sci-Fi Channel or the Space Channel in Canada or BBC or somebody did a mini-series that was a more mm-hmm. direct, faithful translation.
Well, one of the things I enjoyed in the book was that the keys opened a gate and you had to do something behind that gate to get the clue. Versus this, you got the key, you immediately turned the key, and the next clue popped out at you.
None of the war game stuff, none of a lot of the other pop culture sort of things.
The flick sync, as they called it, or the live-action video game, if you will.
Yeah, the flick sync, I think, would have been cool for them to have done.
Yeah.
They did a good job with the stacks. His whole other apartment thing, completely gone.
Yeah. Well, he was already in Ohio.
Yeah. Didn't have to take the bus ride or whatever.
Yeah.
So he never set up the false identity.
Yes.
That whole subplot was gone.
Well, and that was actually how I expected him to get Artemis out, was that they had figured out how to hack the system, so just fix her debt, like he did for himself.
Yeah, but the way they hacked the system is the guy had written his password down.
Yes, as opposed to in the book where, you know, he bought information on how to hack in, because, hey, you never know when that'll be handy.
Well, and Sorrento went from a game designer to a lackey who had worked for the guy, Holiday or whatever. So I thought they made some very serious changes there, and they gave Sorrento a lackey or two.
Yeah.
That we didn't have or need.
I-Rock totally changed.
Yeah. Not a high schooler, as far as we could tell. Definitely not. He had 10 years worth of stuff, so.
Well, and never trying to buddy up to H and Percival.
And Percival, yeah.
And never trying to come across as a Gunter.
Well, and because when you got the key, you got the clue, there wasn't needing to camp out at the place to try the joust game again or something like that.
Yeah.
So we never got the dual force fields.
Yes.
We did get the orb of whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was taken out fairly differently.
Yes.
And not in a bad way, but again, it didn't play quite the same way.
It was less strategic. It was more opportunity.
Yeah. It was more, I need to go here, do this, get the answer, and then go use the answer, versus I need to plan my attack.
Well, and then you had random Gunters willingly throwing their weapons to someone wearing a Sixer uniform.
They hadn't established by that point that people knew Percival's car and stuff like that?
No. Nor had they established that people knew Artemis's face.
Well, she was at least in the car when they were throwing weapons, so there's a little bit of that. Did you notice the difference on the car from the book?
No Ghostbusters on the side and the different license plate.
Yeah, those are the main ones. And then the Firefly reference was not his ship, it was Daito's.
Yeah.
And instead of Ultraman, it was, it was Iron Giant for H.
Mm-hmm.
No Lepardon, the Spider-Man robot guy. And for Daito, it was Gundam.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew they were going to have to flip some of that.
Yeah.
And some of the site kind of Easter eggs or whatever. We saw Beetlejuice at one point and other various Warner Brother characters.
Yeah.
Marvin the Martian at one point.
When they seem to have the High Five guys working in cooperation with each other starting much earlier.
Way earlier. And meeting way earlier.
Yes. The meeting way earlier I was okay with compared to the we're solos versus helping one another through even the first gate.
Yeah.
And more blatantly than in the book.
Yeah, they teamed up way faster. They met Og officially way later.
Yes.
And the subplot of Percival and H played out very differently.
Yeah.
Likewise with Artemis.
Yeah.
And of course, Daito not dying changed that dynamic significantly.
Well, and I'm trying to decide how I feel about how Wade got the quarter with the extra life. In terms of, I really liked it in the book.
Yeah, the Pac-Man thing and him thinking that was part of it and all of that.
Him thinking it was part of it, him fearing he'd wasted most of the time, that he'd lost his chance at the egg, but having that lingering feeling, but if it gave me something, shouldn't it have been important, especially if it's something I can't pull back out of my inventory.
Well, even just the museum of old arcade games.
Yes.
Was nice.
Yeah. And I think that was part of what bummed me towards the end, was that we didn't have the office with the history of computers.
Yeah. Well, there are certain things in the movie, if you haven't read the book, I don't know that you'd fully get the reference to the High Five.
Yes.
Some of the Sixers stuff played out very differently. The Sixers didn't have as much success here as they did in the book.
Agreed.
Because we'd have to go back and re-see some of the scenes with the scoreboard, but I don't know that they ever really got on the board.
They did, but we didn't see enough of the scoreboard to really see it.
It wasn't like they were walking their people through the system.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't really see them walking their people through the system until we saw the adventure game. And that's the only reason we know they had a lot of people on the scoreboard is because of how many people they lined up for the adventure game.
Yeah, that's true. It would have been nice to have seen the ship waiting at the edge of space, have seen kind of the cataclysm blowout go, and then end in this odd cube shape.
Yeah.
You know, sort of thing.
Yeah.
We never got a good map of the universe with the Rubik's Cubus sort of thing. And the Wozniak, or not the Wozniak, the Zemeckis Cube.
Yeah, that was kind of funny.
Didn't work too well for me.
Well, I can go with having a Zemeckis something, but it being the Rubik's Cube didn't quite play for me.
That seemed totally artificial.
Yeah, why mix the two?
I almost would have gone with a Galaxy Quest reference.
Mm.
With the whatever it was that went back 13 seconds or something. But again, getting that whole scene at the nightclub as attempt to get a key or whatever versus Og's birthday party.
Yeah.
Played the celebrity stuff differently, played the quest differently.
Well, it made it feel like to go through the first gate, you had to do it solo. But by the time you wanted to go through the second gate, you needed two of you.
But there was no need to have multiple people for the final gate.
Yeah.
And all the riddles and puzzles and stuff were so different.
Yes.
It's like, here's the plot, let's rewrite the story.
Yeah.
Now they kept most of the characters, I'd say.
I think the characters they didn't keep were the people Alice was renting part of the trailer to.
Yeah.
Which actually takes out some of the high stakes, if you will, of blowing up the stack.
Yeah.
You know, because most of his guilt wasn't from his aunt dying, but from the two innocent families there dying and Mrs. G. And it sure looked like Mrs. G survived.
Yeah, it did. And the We in the Stacks Know What You've Done line didn't play well because I didn't... There was never a reaction shot of the video going out that he...
Yeah.
That Sorrento killed everybody and then going, oh my God,
you know, yeah, whatever. Exactly. Yeah.
And the time from we need an army to having an army was fairly fast.
Was funny.
It takes time to get places was gone.
Yes. Yeah. There was much less you need a ship to move around, much more magic transporting going on.
Yeah. But you've got to kind of cut out some of the whole economics of the Oasis plot line just to fit the thing in a two-hour and 20-minute film, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And I get that anytime you take a book to a movie, you're going to pare out close to half of it.
Yeah.
And I guess I wasn't upset with that because a lot of that was Percival pining over Artemis and stuff like that. But the fact that the quests were different...
Not just different in terms of details, but different in terms of concept.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, if they had changed it from War Games to some other, quote, flick sync movie thing, that would have been fine.
Yeah. Well, and some of the references they had here were much more subtle. The Holy Hand Grenade or whatever.
Yes.
For Monty Python. That was about it, versus the we've got to go do the Monty Python shtick.
Yes.
You know? And again, I get the rights are some of that, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But shifting everything to being in the RV so much sooner, and then having to have them race down the road as they're getting bumped side to side by the IOI guys, as it's like, do you want the key or not?
Yes.
There was some humor out of that.
Yeah.
But it also felt a little movie cliche.
Yes.
So, I had mixed feelings on this, both the movie and the book. I enjoyed both, don't get me wrong. I'd like to see the movie in probably 4K just to get more of the Easter egg kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe the behind the scenes. Did they use motion capture for some of the animated stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. Because the book was going on how hyper-real stuff was in the Oasis, and it felt very video gamey in the movie.
It felt more vibrant colors, like they purposely subdued the colors when we were in the stacks, particularly.
There was some of that, but the whole bit of when they grabbed Sorrento as he was thinking he was logging out.
Yes.
And now it's realistic real.
Yeah.
That didn't quite work for me.
Yeah.
Because by that point in the equivalent in the book, because they didn't have that scene, Percival was saying how muted life felt like compared to that. And for them to have whipped that office together in minutes.
They seem to have changed H's skills.
Yeah, H was a programmer, hacker, and builder of things. A Minecraft builder, I guess, equivalent in the Oasis. Versus being just another gunter.
Yeah, a gunter and a fighter.
Yeah.
I forget what kind of fighting it was that he did on the weekends to make money.
Well, and the brothers were not only talented Oasis fighters, but good in the real world, at least the older one.
Yeah.
And the older one got the shorter end of the script.
Oh, definitely.
But he survived it.
He got the short end of the book, too, in some respects.
He did, but he seemed like a more defined character in the book.
Yes. And I think part of that is because of the quest that the brothers and Wade wound together.
Yes.
And I missed that.
Yeah, they seemed to get looped into the whole thing. The High Five formed a team before they were the High Five.
Yes, yeah.
Almost loosely knit, and then it became fairly official fairly quick.
Yeah. we didn't even get kind of those defining moments for the older brother when the brothers were doing a quest with H, without Wade.
Yeah.
And that was an opportunity to give us that same feeling of honor.
And we never got an idea of how Wade and H met.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things that, I mean, it works as a movie, but you get the richer tapestry in a book.
Yeah.
But I do think there's an opportunity for this to become a, should somebody be able to secure the rights they would need to do it, an actual miniseries and such.
Yeah.
You know, let some time play out between the different gates and stuff like that.
Yes.
But...
Well, and that's where the fact that the book had such a rich universe really paid off. Is in a miniseries or a series, you could have what, in a typical show, we would call throwaway episodes. But they're episodes that are not the quest, or not getting the keys, but the red herrings, which is how he got the extra life quarter.
I was going to say, the Pac-Man game and stuff like that.
Yeah. The things that later you discover, oh wait, I picked up an artifact that is useful now. Who knew?
Yeah.
And there wasn't much of the picking stuff up along the way. We got the coins early on for fuel.
Really, that was about it. Mm-hmm. How he had what he had.
Yeah.
Was never explained in the movie.
And there wasn't much about leveling or leveling up.
But there was the reference to the 99 level avatar, and the whole leveling thing wasn't there.
Yeah.
So, if you haven't read the book and you had some loose ends from the movie, I think it's worth reading the book.
Yes, that's a good, yeah.
But that's, I think, usually the case between, you know, a movie and a book.
True.
I think you're always better off kind of reading the book first, because the movie's going to give you just enough, but probably not sell you on the full concept. Whereas the book, you get the full thing.
Yeah.
So, it was good. By and large, I thought they cast fairly well.
Yeah.
They went a different way with Sorrento than I would have gone.
Mm-hmm.
The choice of Simon Pegg for Og was good.
Yeah.
He was used lighter than I had expected. More in flashback than in present day.
Yeah.
We never really got much on the wife.
Yeah.
And Holiday had a uber geekiness to him that worked.
Yeah.
I felt some of the answers, though, like race the thing backwards, were a little too literal.
Yes.
There wasn't, like, the Captain Crunch, the whistle, the trophies.
Yeah.
From the book and stuff. So I get they had to de-geek it some.
Yeah.
But I think that's something, if, again, you did it as a mini-series, you could actually geek it up.
Yes.
Spend an episode or two, it's like, well, what's this? Well, it might be this, it might be that, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of almost doing an 80s archaeology.
Yes.
So, like I said, it was fun, it was good. Do I think it is this brilliant, you know, piece of art, either in the movie or the book? Not entirely. I mean, it's got traces of that. It's got, it's good, it's entertaining, but it fell a little short of kind of that be-all, end-all mark, I guess, for me.
Well, for me, it's good light entertainment, but it's not one of those, I feel like I gotta watch it two or three times to make sure I caught all the little details.
Yeah, I guess for me, if there's a good YouTube video that has, hey, did you catch these things? Yeah, sure, why not? Or a how it should have ended sort of thing. Because those can usually be pretty funny. But it's one that I think doing multiple sequels to, or, you know, it's not a franchise.
Yeah.
It was a good run. If they do a sequel for the book, I'll consider it at some point. But it's not like, ooh, I've got to go read that now.
Yeah, I can see that.
So I can see where it caught people's attention, but it to me, it's not like it's the next Harry Potter or something.
Yeah. Well, and the movie did have Artemis on screen earlier and a lot more than the book did, which fits with the impression I had gotten.
Yeah. No, she was definitely a much more of a key player here.
Yeah.
Particularly with the resolution there at the end.
Yeah.
If anything, H was sidelined a bit to make room for that.
Yeah.
So, again, it's worth watching. It's fun. Different between the TV and the movie, or the book and the movie, as should be expected. But still enough of the same basic plot trajectory.
Yeah.
And basic plot points, even if the details are different.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not like, geez, how did they get from there to here kind of a deal.
Yeah. Well, and I think the movie did a better job with not just Wade wanting to share the financial prize, but wanting to share every part of the prize he could.
Mm-hmm.
The running of the Oasis, etc. And that was one thing they didn't do in the movie, was the passing of the robes.
Yeah, that would have been nice. And the building of the team worked better here.
Yeah.
Because it happened sooner.
Yeah. Well, and it felt like there was better reason for it, and it was a bit more natural.
It was, but there was never the sense of the high five was starting to be assassinated. There was, that part felt...
There were targets on their backs versus they were being assassinated, if that makes sense.
Even on the targets on their back didn't seem to be as much of a plot point here as it was in the book.
Well, because it was only really Percival and Artemis.
Yeah.
And we didn't get an explanation for how Helen and the brothers got together.
We never got the scene where Percival hacked in, saw the files.
Yeah.
And saw exactly what Sorrento was up to.
Yeah.
So that's why at the end when Sorrento was getting arrested, I'm like, what exactly did he do that was so wrong here?
Yeah.
Because he was a full-on bad guy, having, you know, threatened to kill and having killed multiple people.
Yeah.
Versus just the bombing here, as if that's not bad enough.
Yeah. The bombing and holding a gun on five kids in front of witnesses. That's comparatively minor.
I didn't understand why he didn't shoot Wade there at the end of the movie.
All the witnesses. That's my only guess. And he could see in the visor that Wade already had the egg.
Yeah, kind of. He'd already lost.
It was a pointlessness to it. One of the things they set up in the book that they kind of put in as a throwaway line that never paid off was, I would find out later, the keys were non-transferable.
Yes.
Even if somebody died, you couldn't get a key from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that both in the book and the movie, I wanted them to pick up on and do something with.
Well, and that was another thing. When everybody else got wiped out, he didn't need any of their stuff.
Yeah.
To go mount an ad hoc kind of, you know, attempt to get to the key.
Yeah. Well, the plant wasn't as destroyed. The castle wasn't as destroyed. It wasn't the pit and ruins that yeah. was in the book.
But there wasn't the treasure trove of riches as everybody else had gotten wiped out.
Yeah.
And he didn't resurrect everybody else.
And Sorrento reappeared quite quickly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, quite a few changes.
But, again, to be expected.
Yeah. Enjoyable, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have gone with all the changes they did or not, but I certainly saw where some changes were going to have to have been made.
Yeah.
Just for the licensing and such.
Well, and the time.
Well, and the time. But I think, you know, when you cover so many, you know, such a wide scattershot thing in the book, that whatever studio you work with can't grab all those rights to do it.
Well, no, I was thinking in terms of it was 2 hours and 20 minutes without having the flick sync, without live action video game. So even if they had given me everything I wanted, we're probably talking a 3-hour movie.
Agreed, and that's part of why I think a miniseries makes sense.
Yeah.
But other than him playing adventure at the end, I never really felt like he was playing games.
Yeah.
So there's that. Again, it was fun. It was enjoyable. It's different. I recommend if you're into the 80s culture and stuff like that, read the book, check out the movie.
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't think it's something that everybody absolutely positively must do before they die sort of thing. It's fun. So we good?
We're good.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.